Welcome back to the Effective Ministry Podcast, the podcast that helps you to have an effective youth and children's ministry in your local church. My name is Tim Bielharts. I'm a children's ministry advisor for YouthWorks in Sydney, and I'm joined on the podcast today by David Rietveld. David has served in youth ministry and senior ministry at both Anglican and Baptist churches in Sydney, the Illawarra, Melbourne, and most recently at Dapto Anglican Church, just south of Wollongong. David has also recently written a book called Being Christian After Christendom. Where are we? How did we get here? What went wrong? And what is the solution? Before going into church ministry, David's training was in sociology, and one of the things I really appreciated about this book was the sociological lens that David brings to understanding Christianity, church, and a Christian's place in our Western culture. As the title suggests, David's argument is that we're not in Kansas anymore. He writes in the introduction, "This is a sociological book written by a Christian for Christians struggling to make sense of a post-Christian world." While there's lots in the book that is helpful in understanding our post-Christian world, the main question I had for David was, so what for youth and children's ministry? How do we raise young people to be Christians in a post-Christian world? And how do we effectively communicate the gospel to those who are not yet Christian? As always, I'd love to hear from you about your impressions of the Effective Ministry podcast. What's working well? What would you like to hear more of? Who should we be talking to, or topics that we can be talking about that will help you have an effective youth and children's ministry? You can email us at effectiveministrypodcast@youthworks.net, or come and find our new Facebook page and follow, like, and then comment under the post to keep this conversation going. That's enough housekeeping from me. I really enjoyed this interview with David, and I hope that you find it beneficial as well. Let's dig in. Welcome, David. Thanks for jumping on the podcast. In your book, you've written that we need to be Christians in the post-Christian worldview to reach and disciple those who inhabit this new world, not the previous one. God has called you and me to be the church of the 2020s, not the 1960s. And so the key question that we're going to be talking about is, well, how do we do children's and youth ministry in the 2020s and not in the 1960s? Now, when I talk to Christians who remember the 1960s, they're very aware of how the culture has changed. And they see it often as a loss. They're mourning the things that have passed. They see, you know, they remember the Christian worldview being really dominant in their world. You tease out throughout your book, you say that we are experiencing not the end of Christianity in the West, but the end of the West as a Christian culture. What's the difference there you're trying to tease out, and how does that help us understand this shift that's happened from the 1960s to the 2020s?
Great question. And the people who are lamenting what we had in the 1960s and have lost are often conflating two things. So let's just tease out two different types of statistics. If you, in a census, say who believes in God, who calls themselves a Christian, right? In the 1960s and before, it was 90%+. Right? And it was that way for something like 15 centuries in Western countries. So, you know, England, Italy, France, Spain, and all the countries that they colonized, like North America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. For pretty much all of our history, up until the last couple of decades, 90-something% of people said, I'm a Christian. Did they go to church? Not all of them. Church attendance for centuries has wavered between, say, 10 and 40%. So we walk into a cathedral when we're on holidays in Europe and we go, imagine the days when this place was full every Sunday. It never was.
Right.
Okay. So cathedrals were full maybe at the end of a war or at the beginning of a pandemic, but for the most part, church attendance has never been parallel to the number of people who say they're a Christian. So the people who say, I'm a Christian, they subscribe to a Christian worldview. But the people who attend church most weeks, they are probably the real Christians, and there's always been a big gap between those two.
All right. So help us to understand this language of worldview. It helps us describe the water that we're swimming in. There's that classic, the two fish swimming by, the old fish says, how's the water? And the young fish goes, what's water? There's that idea that the worldview is just this world that we're enmeshed in that we often don't question, we don't really understand. So help us to understand this Christian worldview, that the Christian world that has lasted for many, many centuries, What are its main tenets? What did people believe and think? What was in that atmosphere and the water of the world in the Christian worldview?
Yeah, the unquestioned shared assumptions when people ticked "I believe in God" in the census box was a notion that somehow the world begins with God. He creates it on purpose. It's heading in a certain direction towards a certain goal. It has a moral fabric in that universe. There are absolute rights and wrongs. God is just and fair. There will be a day of account, a day of reckoning, where we will be judged for the good and the bad things that we've done. And that will determine where we spend eternity, right? Pretty much everybody believed that, whether or not they went to church every Sunday. And those were the core beliefs of the Christian worldview. Now, people also believed that Jesus was a great moral example of how we ought to live. But only the genuine Christians believed that Jesus Christ was their Lord and Savior, and they actually needed to repent and put their faith in him. Everybody believed Jesus was a real person, a good guy, somebody we ought to try and imitate, but not everyone believed he was their Lord and Savior.
So you've got this overarching belief in the world that the claims of Christianity are probably true in some extent, but that doesn't mean that everyone was a disciple of Jesus and attending church regularly and committing themselves, submitting themselves to the Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
We can kind of reverse engineer out of the gospel presentations that were common from the 1960s to the 2000s what was going on, right? So everyone believed in a God, everyone believed in right and wrong, everyone believed in sin, shall we call it, and then a just God, a day of judgment. Most people believe that if I do more good than bad, I'll probably make it to heaven because God is somehow just and loving. And evangelism in that kind of a worldview is, well, you've got most of the pieces of the puzzle right, but there's one we just need to flip. You're not actually saved by good works. You're not actually saved by doing more good than bad. Any sin is a problem for God because he's a perfect holy God. You actually need to ask for forgiveness in Jesus, who lived the perfect life and died in your place. So I think that kind of tells us what the assumptions were, how evangelism worked, and what was unique about the Christians.
All right, so let's give us a picture of on the ground. What is it like for those who are genuinely disciples of Jesus as they live their life in a Christian worldview culture? What's it like for them? What are they experiencing?
Yeah, they have the benefit of what you might call the default status. So when somebody steals, they say, that's a sin. People know what sin is as a category. People believe in sin. People feel guilty when they sin. People have this intuitive sense that there will be a day of account where your sins will be weighed up. And so our core beliefs, like there's a God, there's a moral fabric to the universe, there's a day of judgment, there's an afterlife, Jesus is the kind of guy you should be living like. Everyone believes those. And so we don't need to work too hard to disciple our children. They will just pick up that stuff because everybody believes it.
Yep.
Right? And when we try and explain the gospel, we have people who are wired to hear certain parts of the gospel. Like if you have a sense that sin is a problem and I'm feeling guilty because I know I've done some stuff that's wrong, when you try and talk about Jesus offers forgiveness, well, that fits.
Mm.
So our assumptions are shared assumptions. It's easier to disciple and it's more obvious about how you have gospel conversations. People are more ready to hear them because they're wired to think in Christian categories.
So even for the average Joe on the street who's not a disciple of Jesus, who's not attending church regularly, they have these frameworks of thought. They've got these ideas where talking about the gospel, talking about Jesus type things kind of makes sense because it already fit in their patterns of thought.
So I tell a story in my book about criminals on a place called Sarah Island in Tasmania. It's where the worst of the worst criminals go. It's a penal colony. And life is awful there. Like it's freezing, it's exposed, it's this tiny island. And some of the inmates would rather die than live there. Except there's this notion amongst the convicts that if you commit suicide, That's a don't go to heaven, go direct to jail. So what some convicts do is they come up with a deal between two convicts, right? One blatantly kills the other and then is found guilty of murder and is hung.
Right.
So both of them get to die. Neither of them get to commit suicide.
Yes, because of this overarching thought that they've all bought into the idea that, well, suicide won't get me to heaven, but these other crimes may.
And behind that, the idea that there is an afterlife.
Yeah.
That as long as I don't commit suicide, the chances are I'll make it to heaven. That there's a God who sees and who's loving and who's just. So there's all sorts of Christian assumptions that even non-Christian convicts, and there will be some Christian convicts, but let's assume most of them are non-Christians, who want to end their lives on penal colonies in the backwaters of Tasmania, they all believe it.
Yep. All right. And so we've got now a situation in the 2020s where you've described that we've lost the Christian worldview that is not describing the world, particularly in the modern West and Australia where we are. We've now got a post-Christian worldview, which is the dominant thought in our culture. So what are its main tenets?
Yeah, they're different. And part of the problem is that when I say them, you'll know some of them, but they're not written down somewhere in like the Ten Commandments.
Yep.
So they're not in some sort of a list. But here's a few, right? You do you. The concept that somehow you're the captain of your own ship. You're the expert on yourself. You're most in touch with your thoughts, your feelings, your passions. And if you follow your desires and you chase with everything you've got, then you will find some sort of path to self-fulfillment, to happiness. You'll be a better person. You'll make the world a better place. The kind of people you've got to watch out for are the powerful. They will abuse you. They will take advantage of you. They have their own self-interests in heart. So all power is kind of evil. Yeah. So these are kind of the core assumptions. Be authentic, be yourself, and you'll be happy and you will be a positive influence in the people around you.
There's been a number of books written in the last decade or so that try to articulate this intellectual history, this cultural history. We've got Charles Taylor's A Secular Age, Carl Truman's Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Christopher Watkins' Biblical Critical Theory all do this. You do it as well in your book. We could spend the whole podcast talking about this cultural history, but are there two or three particular thinkers or particular movements in Western cultural history that for you are just, you know, landmarks? This is where we've shifted in our cultural thinking.
Yeah, there are a number of these books. Most of them are 600 or 700 pages long.
Yep. Which yours is mercifully not.
If you don't have an undergraduate degree in philosophy or something, you're going to struggle.
Yep.
I've got two or three chapters, and I'm not trying to say something new. I'm trying to say something as simple and as accessible as I possibly can. Those guys write great books. I love reading them, but they're not everyone's cup of tea. Couple of names. The first name I would give you is a guy called Rousseau. I met Rousseau when two of my daughters were studying law at university, and I was reading some Rousseau with them and helping them on some of their assignments. And Rousseau opens his most famous book with this quote, man is born free, but everywhere is found in chains. So the idea is that individuals are basically good, but we are corrupted by society. Somehow culture creates the context in which our competitive instincts bring out the worst in us. And in trying to keep up with the Joneses and get ahead, we lie and cheat and steal. Society kind of is this compounding negative rat race. So we're best off just stepping back and being in touch with our true inner selves and letting that express itself. Now you can hear that concept has kind of come home in spades. But Rousseau is kind of thinking those terms in the 1700s, I think it is. The other one is Sigmund Freud. So he's kind of one of the fathers of psychology. So there's a movie out just at the moment by Emma Stone called Poor Things. And in it, it's a girl who has a very mixed past, who's struggling with her identity, a very Rousseau question. Emma Stone is kind of defending the fact that so much of her identity is explored and expressed through her sexuality.
Mm.
That is a Sigmund Freud idea. In the New Testament, Jesus and Paul can be complete individuals, and yet neither of them is married or has sexual expression of part of their personality. In the antiquity, 200-300s, you've got ascetics, right? And there's something spiritual, there's something focused about not pursuing hedonistic sexuality. But Sigmund Freud has flipped all of that, and now core to your identity is your sexuality. And related to that is another idea from Freud, and that is that the problems that you experience are primarily inside you, in your past, things that happened between you and your mother or your father, or things that didn't happen. And somehow when you look inside, the problem and therefore the solution is both inside you, not outside you. So there's a couple of names.
All right. So these are some big thinkers. And as you say, Rousseau is 1700s. Freud is early 1900s. So they're a fair bit removed, but their influences have continued to generate and now influence exactly what we see now. What are some of the ways in which we see the post-Christian worldview playing out for the average Joe or Joanne on the street today?
Yeah, so if we just pick up Rousseau and Freud as a kind of a case in point, most people think I'm basically a good person.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are suspicious of society at large, multinationals, institutions, and the church would be somewhere near the top of that list. So they're also afraid of power. So power is kind of now the big evil, and people who have power self-perpetually chase power, and they only ever abuse power. Nobody's ever using power for good. And so we want to give voice to minorities. That's how justice is now kind of expressed. And the concept of Freud, that somehow my identity is fundamentally a sexual identity, that's very much alive today. And so if you were somebody who, you know, was found to be saving yourself for marriage and, you know, wasn't exploring your sexuality, that would weird people out. My 20-something-year-old daughter was a paramedic, AMBO. She sits with another AMBO for an hour or two. And people would say, are you one of those weird Christians who's like never had sex and you're waiting till you get married before you explore that part of your identity?
Yeah.
And that was just, they'd never met anyone like that.
Yes. Yeah. It's just assumed that you will express yourself through sexuality and your key identity. And we see that in the way that people define themselves, their social media personalities, their bios and those kinds of things as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Your relationship status is core to your identity.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's ask the same questions we did for the Christian worldview. What effect does living in a post-Christian world have on the average church-going disciple of Jesus?
Yeah, far more than what we think. So when we held the default status, when most people believed in God and right and wrong and judgment and afterlife, we didn't need to intentionally, systematically teach worldview. Right. And we also just read the Gospels, we read life, we read our own purpose all through those lenses. And that's the fish thing that you said at the start, right? We had a set of glasses that we didn't even know that we were wearing. We just believed we saw the world exactly as it was. That's had a few effects. One is I'm not sure we're great at teaching worldview. Because we didn't actually have to teach it for 1,500 years.
Yeah, it feels like we're not equipped to do that. We've forgotten how different Christianity is because it had so much overlap with culture and society that the ethic of being a good Australian and the ethic of being a good Christian had such significant overlap, we didn't really think about them as being significantly different.
So we need to teach our young people both to understand and name up the post-Christian culture and its strengths and weaknesses, and to be able to articulate the Christian worldview and say, I believe the Christian worldview, I don't believe the post-Christian worldview, and I believe this for these reasons, and I don't believe this for this reason. Here's an example from my life. My surname is Dutch. I've been to Holland for all of 3 days. My parents left when they were 7 and 8, but I was raised in a very Dutch sub-community. I was part of a Reformed church. There was one point in my life where the street I lived on was one-third Dutchies, and the street it intersected with had 300 Dutch people living on it.
Right.
And the suburb was the most Dutch suburb in the world anywhere outside of Holland. There was a parent-controlled Christian school with lots of Dutchies in it. I played soccer for a Dutch soccer team. I played basketball for a Dutch team. I knew what it meant to be Australian, and I knew what it meant to be a second-generation Dutch person, right? They played footy. We played soccer.
Mm.
They ate donuts with icing. We ate oliebollen, as they were called. They went to the shops on Sundays. We didn't. So I could move in both cultures, but I could clearly articulate what their culture was and what they believed and why my culture was different and better.
Mm.
And I think we would be helped to frame Christians or Christianity as a subculture. Like, it's not like dominant youth culture. So that our youth and young adults can sort of say, yes, I know how Western post-Christendom works, and it's got these strengths and it's got these weaknesses, and I don't follow it for these reasons. But I believe in Jesus and I live this way because I think actually that's better.
So this is starting to get us really practical into where I wanted to make sure we head towards the end here. How do we help those Christian kids, those who are growing up in Christian homes, one or both parents are Christians, they're attending church regularly, they might be in our public schools, they might be in our Christian schools, and how we bring them up to know that they are Christians and what that means. So is there anything else? I think this is really, really helpful, this idea that you have a confident identity in knowing that you are Christian and that you are different to the majority of people you interact with. Any other really practical suggestions for how we can do that well for our children and our teenagers who are already Christians, and we're bringing them up to know and continue to grow in their knowledge and love of Jesus?
We do need to have a confident, distinct identity, but we also need to have a community that's built around that, that reinforces and supports that identity and creates it to kind of be a shared identity. So we have this notion in the West that somehow I believe in the things I believe in because I chose them,
mm-hmm.
right? And I remember I was in Tasmania and Victoria, AFL states, footy. AFL is much, much bigger in those states than what rugby league is in
yep.
New South Wales or Queensland. I would say to high school kids, what footy team do you go for? Oh, Hawthorn, Richmond, you know, Geelong, whoever. Is it the same team as your parents? Yes.
Mm.
Why do you go for the team you go for? Because I chose them.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Then I would say, now, who of you is a Christian? Who of you is not a Christian? Who of you thinks that the people who are Christians are only Christians because they made the same choice their parents make? And everyone would say, yeah, that's why, you know, but they couldn't see the incongruity.
Yep.
They chose the same footy team as their parents, but were critical of Christian kids for following the same faith as their parents. And they didn't appreciate that actually in being agnostics or atheists or individualists or whatever they were, they actually were following the same faith as their parents too.
Yep.
Right. So actually communities with vocabulary, with rhythms, with habits, with sacred symbols, all of that sustains an identity and a worldview. And I think we need to be much more intentional about creating that community and demarcating it as having core values that are clear and that are distinct. And how do we celebrate those? How do we reinforce those? So Sunday, might be framed as we're coming to hear from God, yes, but it might also be framed as we're the people of God who are set apart from the world, and we're coming here to reinforce the things that we believe to be true, that are life-giving, that have been modeled to us in Jesus. These are the things that we value most.
And to be able to articulate coming to church in those kinds of terms, and I was thinking about the sporting analogy as well, like when we put on these particular colours, we're demarcating ourselves. This is us. And we know that when we go to this particular game, particularly if it's a local derby, for example, that half the people in the crowd are going to be wearing the opposite colours to us. We know who we are. We know who they are. We know that there's a distinction there. And, you know, hopefully in a sporting game, there's a friendly rivalry. There's not high antagonism unless you get really fanatics. But there's that idea that I can articulate my colours, I can articulate my team, and I can articulate the others. And it's helping build that kind of language as well for, you know, the Christian faith. I know who I am. I've got my demarcations. These are the things I do, I don't do. It's not as clear as wearing particular colours, wearing particular jerseys. What are some of those other demarcations that we can help raise our kids to, you know, this is what it means to be a Christian in distinction to the majority of the friends you'll meet at school, the majority of the community that you'll bump shoulders with?
Yeah, great question. So I think it's partially going to be about our values. So it's going to be saying, actually, we think that happiness is not something that you chase in and of itself, but it's a byproduct of serving. So actually, it's in giving your life that you find it.
Mm.
And that's what's distinct from us as opposed to the world. There's a kind of a really clear example. A related one, Jesus says, it's better to give than to receive.
Yep.
And that's something that you actually have to experience in order to learn that it's true. It's counterintuitive. The notion of the fact that I'm the expert on me rather than actually a man's ways seem right to him, but God weighs the heart.
Yep.
God knows my heart better than I know it. And Jesus, actually, the more I become like Jesus, the more I will become a whole person and reach my potential.
Yep.
So we want to have some distinct values. We want to have some distinct habits and routines, and that will be things like going to church, going to youth. And actually, I think things like LIT are really critical. So I'm part of a movement. I'm part of something that's bigger. It's not just me. I'm not just isolated. My religion isn't just in decline, you know, but there's a whole movement here that I'm kind of part of, and I find my identity as a subset of that. Rituals are also really important. It's fascinating kind of watching the football codes as they kind of practiced Indigenous round or formation round, or, you know, they're actually, they have liturgies now around what they wear and playing the last stand on the trumpet and, you know, and they're celebrating mateship or choice or whatever it is, connecting your rituals to your belief system and then reinforcing those. And historically, that's what we do in communion.
Yep.
But I think we can find some new versions of these, and youth ministries can kind of, and children's ministries can have their own creative local take on these.
Mm.
So I think facilitating all of these sorts of things is really helpful for just establishing ourselves as the people of light in a dark world.
Yep. And youth ministry is a really great way for young people to be exploring and coming up with creative ways to have those rituals and iconography or whatever it is that helps them reinforce their identity. Let's think about those who are not growing up Christian. So the majority of our world are not growing up with Christian parents. They're not attending church weekly, but a large part of our churches, hopefully, is going to be wanting to mission, to be able to communicate the gospel to them, to be able to communicate to them that the Christian understanding of the world is a better world, a better understanding than what they currently have. But you, in your book, you talk about the difficulty that we come across with mission and evangelism. You've already highlighted that the language that we use around evangelism, when we assume that they understand sin, they understand guilt, you know, in a Christian worldview might work, but we're talking to people in a post-Christian worldview who won't have the same understanding of some of these key concepts. They don't even have these concepts in their worldview. How do we evangelize effectively to children and young people who do not share that language, but we want to communicate clearly the beauty of the gospel?
Yeah, great question. The first thing I would say is I'd begin by listening. Christians have a reputation for being a bit preachy, and maybe last century we taught people to share the gospel by giving presentations, which could come across as preachy. Because of that reputation, combine that with the fear of power and institutions and organized religions and whatever else, people very quickly tune out and block their ears. But we also live in a world where love looks like tolerance, and it's kind of like you do you over there and I actually won't get too involved unless you're particularly part of my close circle of influence. I think there's a lot of lonely, isolated people. And if we genuinely listen and care and are present for people, that gives us some credibility and some reciprocity. I've done something and now you're kind of more open. But we're not just listening and affirming. We're listening and kind of saying, what are the yearnings present in your life? This happens with Jesus, right? He talks to blind people about seeing. He talks to fishermen about becoming fishers of men. He talks to farmers about different types of soils and seeds. And we want to listen, what are the yearnings of our not yet Christian friends? And where are their yearnings kind of a perversion? And we might need to point that out to them. But is there something there that actually is a theme that Jesus fulfills in ways that they're not quite appreciating and looking for just at the moment? So if we take somebody who says, I want to flourish, we could have a conversation around, well, where do things most flourish? Is it out in the wild or is it in a garden? And if the answer is in a garden, what makes a garden different from the wild? And the answer is a gardener, right? So we might kind of have a conversation with somebody about flourishing and introduce God as some kind of a gardener who's overlooking the entire ecosystem and making it possible for individuals to flourish, but there's some rules to flourishing and not flourishing. So now your conversation can go anywhere, and it's really hard to get your head around this on the spot. Mm. People can kind of be afraid and kind of go, oh, it was much easier to learn a gospel presentation. I've got a page on my website, davidbrickfeld.com, where I explore what I think are the dominant yearnings and some gospel windows that flow out of those yearnings. But here's a great get out of jail card. Have a listening conversation. And then when your friend gets to somewhere deep and meaningful, say, wow, that's really important. That's profound. I need to think about that some more. Can I come back to you and we chat about this again, right? And then go home and ring up your youth pastor and say, hey, what do I say? I'm stuck. But that is both affirming, and people will feel like, wow, they're invested, they're interested. And when you come back, hopefully they're even more primed to listen.
One of the things I really appreciate about your take on the post-Christian worldview, and I see this in Christopher Walken's book as well, is that there are things that we can notice that are positive in the way, in the framing of the post-Christian worldview. So we don't need to demonize. We don't just need to say, oh, no, your beliefs are all rubbish. Let's fit here. You can do exactly what you just said. You can notice, oh, that's profound. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, you are on your way to something that I would affirm. And yet here is how the gospel kind of comes alongside that. And you actually see it as a better version of the belief that you have as well, that we can have these conversations in a non-anxious, not really, not overly defensive kind of way. Just to sort of finish up, like what's the tone that you would recommend that we have these conversations in, the way that we lead youth group and the way we do scripture in schools and these kind of things? What's the tone that we come with when we're helping present the gospel to those who have such a disconnect in the language and the worldview that we're sharing.
Yeah, let me just affirm what you're saying and then I'll answer your question. In Acts 13, Paul is in Antioch and he shares the gospel in a synagogue to Jews. And he talks about David and he talks about the Messiah and he's got all of these biblical categories. And we kind of go, oh, that's a great sermon. The next chapter, he's with some rural farmers and he talks about how you can know God because he provides the seasons. And he cares for us. And then in Acts 17, he's with some philosophers in Athens, and he has this great line that God has placed us where we are, and God is not far from us.
Mm.
And I take heart from that. I think there is a sense in which every culture is not that far from God, because there are some fundamental yearnings of the human spirit that have a twist in every culture. And every new culture, there's a different twist. But somehow, Satan always has a counter narrative. And there is a truth there that Jesus is the answer to in every single culture. Mm. Now, would I prefer my grandchildren grew up in Christendom to post-Christendom? Yes. but I'm not alarmist about post-Christendom. And I don't think Christians ought to be in general. God is the God of every culture, and Christians grow and evangelize in every culture. So what's our tone? I think our tone is to be quietly confident, genuinely interested in other people, and to be non-anxious. And we want to not just share with people ideas, but we actually need to walk alongside people and invite them to experience Christian community. So there's a kind of a double barrel of they're hearing it and they're experiencing it. And then we also recognize that ultimately it's up to God whom it is that he wants to call. So if there are less people being saved in our generation than what there might have been in the 60s or in the 50s, well, that's okay. Church attendance has gone up and down across thousands of years, and it probably will do. I'm not sure that we're coming to the end of Christianity. In fact, I'm confident we're not. It might not be as big politically as what it was, but that's okay. Jesus won't let the gates of hell overcome his church.
Yeah, it's a good reminder that being big at a worldview, cultural level, being big at a political level is not actually the measures of success that Jesus gives us in the Gospels anyway.
And it's not how he does ministry.
No.
And, you know, Jesus is presumably the greatest evangelist ever. And at the end of 3 years, he's got, what, maybe 120 followers?
Mm.
Now, those 120 changed the world.
Yeah.
But, sometimes I think we can expect too much too quickly.
Yeah. I like what you said as well, and this is a section in your book that I really appreciated, the importance of Christian communities. And I just think that when we have formed positive Christian communities with those who are in our churches and then we invite people to come and experience those, that is another opportunity for them to say, oh, this is what it – when you say – Christianity, when you say you're living as Christian values, this is what you mean. Oh, that's really intriguing. It just helps to build that relationship as well.
And it's not just that they understand the gospel, but in a culture that is more about feelings and vibe, it's that they kind of go, actually, this feels right.
Mm.
There's something about love and justice and freedom in this community that is genuine and different. And I want to know more.
That's great. Well, David, thank you so much for your time. You start this book by saying it's a sociological book written by a Christian for Christians struggling to make sense of a post-Christian world. I would heartily recommend the book to everyone. It is called, I don't know if we've said this yet, it is called Being Christian After Christendom. And I'll put the links for where you can find that in the show notes as well. David, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks, Tim.
The Effective Ministry Podcast is a production of Youth Works in Sydney. We want to see effective youth and children's ministry in every church. One of the ways that you can help us do that is by letting people know about this podcast in all the usual ways, like, comment, share, and review on your favorite social media and podcasting platform. If you've got comments, thoughts, or questions for this podcast, you can email us at effectiveministrypodcast@youthworks.net. And also check out youthworks.net for other ways that YouthWorks can help you have effective youth and children's ministry in your church.